Hello, welcome to the House of Comments podcast. This is a regular podcast featuring me, Lib Dem blogger Mark Thompson, and also regularly featuring my co-host Emma Burnell, who blogs at the Labour Scarlet Standard blog. Good evening, Emma.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. Okay, so we are going to try and cover two or three topics tonight. The first one, we sort of slightly covered last week, but the announcements, it's to do with the announcements that Ed Miliband made about how Labour's going to be funded in the future, or possibly not funded in the future, is more significant in his announcement. We slightly covered this last week because we did have an embargoed release of what he was going to say, or what we thought he was going to say, and he pretty much did say what we thought. So we talked about it a bit, but there's some specific aspects of this that have the way the story's rumbled on during the week that we thought we might just try and touch upon. So Emma, what are your thoughts about this, having had 7 days to reflect on it now, and the ramifications and the way the political debate is now moving on? Do you think Ed's done a good job here of wresting control of the political agenda on this subject? Because we're not really talking about Falkirk anymore, are we? We're talking about party funding and how the other parties are funded as well. So do you think he's done a good job?
I think Ed's really taken the momentum on this one and run with it. In many ways, it's similar to what happened over the phone hacking thing, where he saw an opportunity to do the right but difficult thing. It's almost exactly the same thing. Is it the right thing for the party? Is it the right thing for your electoral advantage? Or is it just the right thing to do? It challenging the Murdoch press was very much seen as the wrong thing to do for political advantage, but the right thing to do morally. And that's very much the same with this party funding debate. Ed's got himself on the right side of the argument, but we are looking at a funding difficulty that will arise as a result of that. But now the pressure is completely on the Tories, their funding arrangements, where their money comes from. And actually, figures are starting to arise that it's actually the public are much more concerned about the hedge fund donors and the big corporates that are putting money willy-nilly into the Tory party than Labour's long-standing relationship with the unions. And I think that's in part because Ed has neutralised that concern about union leaders having more influence perhaps than union members, which I think is a really important thing to do. And also because by highlighting our own frailties and standing up and saying we accept this is a problem, we're going to deal with it, that then challenges other parties to do the same.
Yeah, I mean, one of the fears that Sonny was expressing, Sonny Hundle, who was our guest last week, is that he was thinking that Ed could have missed a trick here. And I sort of thought this as well, albeit I was digesting it as the podcast was going on, because I only knew what was going to be announced when Sonny told me on the podcast.
Sure.
But his concern was that he thought that the way that this could have been done is that it could have been part of negotiations. So if Ed was willing to give away the union funding, the union bloc funding, then that could have been part of a negotiation with the Tories to get the Tories to accept some kind of cap on donations. And the fact it hadn't been done like that, and Ed was doing this unilaterally and actually doing something that the Tories have been trying to get to happen for many, many years, meant that he had missed a trick. But I wonder if that's true, because these things don't happen in a vacuum, do they? And now that it has been announced, that argument that the Tories always deploy whenever a cap on funding is raised is completely blown out of the water. And it actually, in a strange way, and I think you're right about the hacking scandal, the leader of the opposition has seized the initiative. And I can't really remember a leader of the opposition seizing the initiative in these sort of ways since back in the days of Tony Blair, really, between 94 and 97, when there were times when he seemed more important and more relevant than John Major, even though Major was the Prime Minister. I'm not quite saying it's there yet, but there are signs that he is using the position of leader of the opposition to show that he can take really tough decisions. And a prime minister, a putative prime minister, has to be able to do that.
Yeah. And I think Ed really has shown that core of steel that his supporters always knew was there.
Well, I think the fact that he challenged...
Never really got.
Well, I think the fact he challenged his own brother left, I think, quite a lot of people in no doubt that he has that flash of steel about him.
Well, you'd think, but certainly that's not been the narrative from his major detractors for the last couple of years.
Maybe. I mean, I wonder if there's a bit of, kind of narrative manipulation going on, because never had any doubt about that, and in fact, you've noticed that the Tories have stopped going on about that now. think precisely because they realise that that just helps this idea that actually he is a strong leader and he is willing to, you know, stand up for what he believes in, even if it's to the detriment of his own brother. You know, if he thinks it's best for his party and his country and his own ambitions, let's be honest, you know, politicians who want to get to the top have to have that ability, to that single-mindedness to just do what it takes to get there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, he was the right choice. And I think that's been vindicated, particularly in this last week.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I feel very proud to have worked on his campaign.
So do you think then that the Tories now are on the back foot on this? Do you think actually Cameron is going to feel obliged to do something from his side? Or do you think...
I think it depends how long the pressure can be kept up. The problem with the timing is that everybody's about to go off for the summer. And so the pressure may not stay on. And if it falls away and can't be brought back when the political season returns, then Cameron may feel he's got away with it. It will be up to Labour and campaigners for a better democracy to keep that pressure on the Conservative Party and on the Lib Dems, and on Nick Clegg in particular, to say, you have the power on this one. It was you who stopped the talks. You should start them again. We have a new ball game now. Let's get on with it. Let's do it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Clegg will, but I think he should, for exactly those reasons. The game has completely changed now.
Yeah.
And actually, it could be Labour and the Lib Dems in a very reasonable progressive position on this against the Tories, who will just look like dinosaurs trying to just keep the current settlement. But it's funny as you say about Cameron might try and let this die away, because that was his response to the hacking scandal. He just kept it going and kept it going and just played for time and made sure that Leveson was going to take a very long time to report, and it had moved off the front pages, and because the whole coverage of Leveson had kind of been diverted into celebrity stuff and what Steve Coogan had said, and, you know, what other celebrities that had turned up, and the actual details of it got lost in the midst of all that. And so therefore, when it came to it, and Cameron was able to somehow argue that what Leveson wanted was state control of the press, which wasn't true at all. But because things had become so muddied by that stage, he kind of got away with that. And where are we? We still don't have any kind of press regulation. And we probably won't, certainly no statutory press regulation before the next election. And so he's got form on this, hasn't he? And it could be. And of course, there's high stakes here. We mustn't forget that if Cameron can spin this out and the summer recess and, you know, whatever other devices he can use to spin this out, come 2015, the Tories could have a massive financial advantage against the Labour Party.
Absolutely. And I mean, they always do. They always have more money.
No, that's actually not true. I'm not sure which ones.
I think in some elections where they were really blatantly not going to win,
Exactly. I think 97 and 2000.
Where an election is competitive.
Yeah.
They always have a financial advantage, but where they're so obviously not going to win, there's no point investing in them winning. Business people are business people.
Yeah.
But I think that one of the things that we were talking about last week was the wasted money. And certainly looking at the Tories campaigning air war over the last few elections, they're not terribly good. I mean, their last election was rubbish.
Mm.
If they hadn't been up against such a weakened Labour Party, they should have walked the last election, and they didn't.
Mm.
And they, you know, they had all the money, they had all the impetus, they had their popular leader, they'd done all the, you know, their modernisation, anything that they were going to do anyway. So maybe, and this is possibly a slightly Pollyanna-ish optimism coming through from me, just because the sun is shining, maybe we will be more inventive and more frugal and spend less but do it better on a massive election campaign because we are going to be constrained. And maybe the difference in those election war chests won't mean as much as it does. I mean, we don't have the kind of electoral advertising battles that they have in the States, which is where the real money goes.
Yeah.
So in terms of what we can and can't do, we're still quite constrained by electoral law, which hopefully would mean that it's not possible to buy these elections in quite the same way. So, you know, maybe because the sun is shining, maybe because I went to a lovely party last night. But, I'm feeling, if not optimistic, then at least happy that we've done the right thing, however much that may hurt in the short term and that however much that may change the game for us.
Yeah, I think you're going to have to hope that at least an element of what you've said comes to pass, because otherwise I think there is a risk that you will be outspent, and you could be outspent massively. I mean, it's not beyond the bounds of possibility there.
But it's whether they waste the money or not.
I completely understand what you're saying. And, you know, maybe this is short term, looks quite bad, but long term, we'll look back on this and we'll think that this was a very, very good move by Ed. Time will tell, I guess. Yeah.
There has been other things this week that are connected to this party funding row.
Oh, yeah.
So, for example, the government this week decided not to go for plain packaging on cigarettes.
Yeah.
And David Cameron's right-hand man is a certain Mr. Linton Crosby, who is a paid lobbyist for tobacco. I think it was David Schneider, certainly somebody on Twitter said the Tories have decided they can't give up their 20 lobbyists a day habit.
Yeah, I saw that.
And this is part of the debate, you know, are people buying legislation from the Tories?
Yeah, but I don't know if you've seen, though, that the Tories have dismissed this claim as a smear. So we've got to move on.
Really?
We can't talk about it because it's a smear.
When it's the unions, it's a very important threat to our democracy.
Yeah.
When it's shadowy business figures from tobacco, then it's just a smear and there's nothing to see here and we need to move on. Oh, I see.
Yeah, yeah. I made exactly that point in a tweet earlier on today. Yes. So, no, I mean, I think you're right. And I think that this tobacco thing probably wouldn't have been as big a story if it wasn't for the fact that party funding has been in the headlines for the last days. I think it'd have, there'd have been some comment on it, but we'd have moved on quite quickly.
Again, it speaks to the transparency agenda that this government launched in 2010, all guns blazing, and have just completely left behind.
Well, Cameron made a very specific speech about this just before the election, the 2010 election, where he said that lobbying going to be the next big scandal. It's a scandal that's waiting to break. And yet he's done nothing about it.
No, and there's no register that was promised. That keeps getting pushed into the long grass. There's no reformation of things like second jobs. That was one of the other good things that Ed came up with, was this stuff about MPs having second jobs.
Yeah.
Why anyone with a £65,000 salary feels they need a second job is beyond me, but obviously I have low expectations or something.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, but I think if you do, then 90-odd% of the population do as well. So, yeah.
And the MPs that I know from all parties work really, really hard and really, really long hours because it's a bloody hard job. Now, I don't want to go into the MP's pay issue because I think that's a separate issue. But if you are being an MP, being an MP properly means taking up an awful lot of time. There's incredibly hard things that people have to deal with. The idea that you can give up some of that time to go off and earn money in the city or money as a lawyer is just silly.
Yeah.
And I think Ed's quite, quite right about this.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there is a tension here because it's the tension between the fact that, you know, MPs, I don't think, should be paid really much more than they're paid at the moment. And so on the one hand, people could argue, so allow them to have second and third jobs and directorships and so forth, and therefore we won't need to pay them from the public purse so much. But I cannot understand how an MP can do the job of being an MP justice if they're spending 10, 20, 30 hours a week, however long it is or however short it is, focusing on something else. Because I suppose the other argument as well is that it keeps them in touch with what's going on in the world. But if if the surgeries and all of their other political duties don't keep them in touch with what's going
on. Absolutely. What keeps you in touch with the world is going out into the world and talking to the people you represent.
Yeah.
Not going into the boardroom.
Well, I tell you what, and I made this suggestion a couple of years ago, because I think at the time, I don't know if it's true now, but William Hague was the highest earning Member of Parliament in terms of various, you know, other responsibilities and jobs that he had. And I remember I said in a blog post, because he tried to defend himself by saying that, you know, it keeps him in touch and it keeps him involved in other things and it means he can bring more experience to Parliament. And I said, fine, okay, no problem. So any money that you get from those, you should give to charity then, or, you know, give back to the Exchequer.
Yeah.
Because if it's just for the experience, then you don't need the money. And of course, none of these MPs do that.
No.
They do it, and they trouser the money. Well, most of them don't.
Actually, all of the Gordon Brown's money that he's earning outside of Parliament is going to charity.
Yeah, Gordon Brown is an honourable exception, although you might argue that he had so long at the top that he can now afford to do that. Although, I would say the same should apply to William Hague. He's been at or near the top for a very long time as well. Anyway, I think you're right, we shouldn't get diverted too much into MPs' pay, because that's a topic all on its own.
Indeed.
So the other topic we thought we might talk about, or one of the other topics, was the immigration backlog, which has been reported on this week. And, I mean, I suppose there's no getting around this. It is a scandal. There's 500,000 people plus who apparently shouldn't be here and who are here. And the system just hasn't been able to deal with them, or hasn't dealt with them. And apparently at the current rate of processing, it's going to take 37 years to clear this backlog. And of course, realistically, in 37 years, I think we know what will happen. There will be more people added to that list. So it's never going to be cleared. Maybe I would say this because I'm a Lib Dem, but this seems to happen on the watch of every government, of every stripe. You know, politicians talk tough on immigration, say they're going to do stuff. But then when it comes down to it, there are always problems like this. And it almost seems like an intractable thing. You know, when we're in a situation... I saw Keith Vaz actually came up with a very soundbite-friendly thing of the number of people now on this list would fill Wembley Stadium six times over, so a nice little accessible way of looking at this. That keeps getting quoted, I see. I mean, what do you think about this? I mean, do you think there's anything that can be done about this, or is immigration just going to be a perennial problem that will never go away and will never be resolved because it's just seen as like a political hot potato and politicians are basically scared of it? It's like a third rail issue, isn't it?
Well... I think politicians are less scared of it than they were. I mean, you can't go a week without a politician having a conversation, about immigration.
Yeah, but in a way that kind of proves the point, doesn't it? That they might talk about talking about it, but they don't necessarily talk about it.
I mean, the thing is, you've got the Tories talking about it whilst cutting the immigration services, Tories and Lib Dems. I mean, this government has made cuts to the immigration services. You've got Labour talking about it because we need to talk about it because people feel that we didn't do enough. I think the problem is that no matter what is done, and if we ended all immigration tomorrow, it wouldn't shift public perception hardly at all. I mean, crime halved in the last 20 years, but people think it's gone up. And I think there's just a perception rather than a reality that people are dealing with in terms of what immigration is and what they mean by immigration. Quite a few people might say, oh my God, I live in this community that's completely swamped by immigrants. Actually, most of the people they're talking about were born here, have lived here all their lives, are second or even third generation. So that's not necessarily the case. And it's not an immigration problem. It might be an integration issue, but it's not an immigration issue. And the other thing is this 500,000 backlog. That's backlog of cases to be decided, isn't it? Rather than people who shouldn't be here. We shouldn't necessarily assume that all of those people are people who should be deported. And it's just as hard for the people awaiting decisions. It can be incredibly crippling for people who... I know of one case where somebody has waited a decade for a decision on what was perfectly straightforward and, you know, has been given leave to stay, as was quite right. It was quite an obvious case. And they were on the phone to the Home Office every week, and it's just ridiculous. And that has led to severe depression, severe difficulties, having to move to work because you couldn't have work status. So actually, we need to stop thinking about this issue just from the point of view of those indigenous peoples who are concerned about immigration, but from the whole of the people across the whole board, including those people who are awaiting decisions, whose lives are severely impacted by the length of time those decisions take.
Yeah, I think one of the problems, just to address one of your points there, is that often when we talk about these figures and this particular issue, various different categories get merged together. So I'm thinking those figures, it's asylum cases, but it's also immigration cases. I mean, they should be treated very differently, but they get lumped in together as if they're all the same thing. And this happens all the time in the media and certainly the tabloid press, where, you know, it is just seen as the same thing. I'm reminded of something that I read a few years ago, which always stuck in my mind, actually, because it kind of demonstrated to me how the public perception of immigration, I mean, in my view, it doesn't really fit in with the reality of what's happening. Now, it's easy for me to say that, because I actually don't live in an area, you know, like in you know, in London, in one of the areas where there's a lot of immigration and, you know, a lot of immigrants have settled. So, you know, it's not happening in my area. I don't really see it, you know, that much. But I do think that the reality of the situation is at odds with a lot of the perception. Mm. And the thing that I remember is I was reading this book by Bill Bryson called Made in America, which is a very good book, actually. I recommend it. It's not really one of his usual ones. It's not like a travelogue. It's actually about the history of the English language in America. So how it evolved in America and place names and how place names were assigned. And a lot of them came from other places. And, you know, from the people who came to America, they brought place names with them. And just the evolution of language and names. It's fascinating. But the bit that stuck in my mind the most is he talks about immigration. Because, I mean, America, the United States of America, is a country that's pretty much built on immigration. The vast, vast majority of people in America can count themselves back a few generations, and, you know, they've descended from immigrants. And what he said is that if you look back at the public discourse and the coverage of immigration back in 1800, take a snapshot at 1850, take a snapshot at 1900, even take a snapshot at 1950, that the situation is such that the prevailing view at each of those points is that the immigration that happened in the past was good and right, but now it's enough. Now we don't want any more immigration.
Mm.
And that's wherever you slice it in the historical record, that is the prevailing view. It seems like it's always the view.
Yeah.
Even from people who descended from immigrants themselves, they think, well, you know, my grandfather came here and that was a good thing, but now we've got enough and the country's full. And, you know, it just doesn't seem to bear any relation to the reality of the situation. And what it also doesn't take into account is how good immigration is for an economy. That always seems to get ignored, you know.
But not just an economy. If you look at our public services, we could not run our public services without immigration.
Yeah, there was an excellent thing again that they did in America, where they I think it was a television program where they showed what would happen if literally all of the immigrants that had come from Mexico, and in fact all the illegal immigrants, just suddenly disappeared overnight, and none of the hospitals would open,
yeah,
none of the equipment would arrive, none of the deliveries would happen, because it's so integral to the functioning of the society, and no one seems to quite realise that.
No, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, and it is integral to our society, and we do not tell the positive story of immigration nearly enough.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's a vital thing to keep alive as part of the debate, because otherwise it's not a debate, it's just a talking shop.
But the point I made earlier on about the third rail issue reminds me of what happened during the leaders' debate in 2010, which was that Clegg tried to talk about the Lib Dem immigration policy. And I'll be straight with you, I don't think our immigration policy was as good as it should have been. And I think it was a little bit incoherent in places, but I think it was well meant. And there were a couple of aspects to it. The first one was that we were trying to find a way of making sure that immigration was more evenly distributed around the country so that it didn't end up in very specific areas where it then can cause problems, with the indigenous population feeling that there is too much immigration, as we've talked about. You know, that he was he had a really hard time on that particular subject during the leaders' debates. And I think the Lib Dems were seen as weak on immigration straight after that. And there was also this idea that after 10 years, you know, people who perhaps would be seen as illegal immigrants could, I think it was described as an earned path to citizenship or something like that. And again, the party was seen as weak. I'm pretty sure, I've never had this officially confirmed, but I'm pretty sure that people close to Nick Clegg and probably Clegg himself think that that particular issue might have cost us 1 or 2 percentage points at the election. And of course, that could make the difference between another 5, 10, 15 MPs, depending on exactly where you cut it.
Yeah.
Because there were quite a few seats we only just missed out on. And I think Clegg has decided never again are we going to make that mistake. And it's sad, really, because I liked the fact that the Lib Dems were distinctive on that issue, even though it was something that could be attacked and was difficult to defend for precisely the reasons we've just been talking about.
Yeah, I mean, overall, the Lib Dems have moved away from having distinctive issues that they own that are not the kind of things the other parties talk about. When you look at what the Lib Dems are pushing very hard as their key achievement, it's the tax cut. Well, you know, all parties talk about tax cuts.
Yeah, I mean,
we had this big ding-dong a few months ago about this, but what is the liberalism in the Lib Dems anymore?
And I disagreed with you to a point, but there was certainly a kernel of a point in what you were saying, and I think it's a shame that, you know, I guess it's the hard graft of government, isn't it? And a lot of our senior MPs are now probably feeling very battered and bruised and feel like they've learned important lessons. I think it's a shame that one of the important lessons, in quotes, they seem to have learned is that what you need to do is ditch your distinctiveness and try and ape the other parties on issues that are seen as controversial. Although, to be fair to the party, actually on drugs, they haven't done that. They have stuck to their guns. Although, having said that, they haven't made a blind bit of difference to government policy.
But no, and also, aren't they making new things illegal?
Yeah, they are. They've made CAT illegal, K-H-A-T, yeah. Which is used predominantly in the Somali community, and I'm absolutely disgusted by that. All I can say is if the Lib Dems were in government on their own, that wouldn't have happened. But, you know, I know a lot of people, a lot of Lib Dems are thinking, what's the point? We have the drugs minister. And yet he's just, okay, I think he's gone off on a fact-finding mission around the world and to Portugal and to the Netherlands and so on and so forth. But, you know, he hasn't actually made any difference on this at all. If anything, it's going in the wrong direction. So I think you can legitimately question what's the point of having a Lib Dem as drugs minister if you don't end up with drugs policy that fits in with the Lib Dem policy. I'm not saying we should be able to force the Tories' hands on everything. I think there was one concession that the Tories made, actually, which was that foil is now going to be distributed at clinics in a way that apparently it wasn't before, because they were worried the foil was going to be used for addicts to smoke heroin. But I think in the end they've realised that smoking heroin is better than injecting heroin, so they've kind of conceded on it. But, you know, it seems like a bit of a mealy-mouthed thing to do.
It's not like put on the front of a manifesto as a huge life-changing thing that's been done.
Yeah, Lib Dems for foil. We should start.
You know, there's a seat where the big foil factory is.
Yeah, where's Baker Foil made? That's a good point, actually. I might see if I can get selected PPC for Baker Foil Shire or whatever it is. Okay, because we haven't got that much time left, so I also wanted to talk about post office privatisation.
Yes.
Which our good friend Vince Cable announced this week. What are your thoughts on that, Emma?
I think it's a ridiculous idea. I think we tried to do it, we couldn't make it happen because it's not actually remotely tenable. And you know, it's not a business you can buy that could be run in the way that people want the post office to be run. I mean, you know, politicians of all parties have tried to persuade the public this is a good idea, and the public consistently tell them to bugger off. And we're not interested in this. It's not something the public are buying. So nobody can convince people this is a good idea. And in a democracy, we probably shouldn't do things that we can't convince people is a good idea.
I mean, there's a whole load of issues all kind of swirling together here. And the first thing I should probably say is my grandfather worked for the post office for most of his career, and he was a very, very staunch advocate of a publicly owned post office, as you might expect. I mean, also my grandfather was a socialist as well. So it's obviously kind of close to the heart of my family. But, I mean, in my view, there have been some good privatisations and there have been some bad privatisations. So I would say that the privatisation of the telecoms industry was a good thing, and I've seen that from the inside because I used to work in telecoms, so I know that the liberalisation of the market as it was done worked very well for that particular industry. But the other areas, like the railways, has been a disaster, and actually I'm pretty much at the point now where I think it should be brought back into national ownership. I'm not saying we should recreate the exact same structure we had under British Rail, but I just think it's a failed experiment. I just don't think it's worked. I'm not sure where a privatisation of the post office would fall. I'm sure you'll say, Emma, it would fall into the latter category. You pretty much have just said that.
Yeah, I don't think the kind of services that people expect from the post office can be run for profit.
My concern is that what will happen is that the good stuff, you know, the stuff that makes the money will be hived off, and the stuff that doesn't make the money will be run down. Yeah. And I'm not sure how much further you can run it down, because we don't have a second post anymore. And, you know,
that's not true. All we have is a second post, as far as we can tell.
Good point. And actually, I've got no idea what time our post even is supposed to arrive. I mean, I work from home quite a lot, and it's, you know, you can almost roll a die.
Variable.
Is it any time between 9 in the morning and about 3 in the afternoon? Now, luckily, I'm not usually desperately waiting by the door waiting for post to come through it. But that was actually going to be one of my other points as well, because, I mean, the post office itself, the age of the internet has had some big effects, and it's had some contradictory effects. So the first one is that more and more people are getting stuff done online. So actually, I just did something today. It was signed up for Lib Dem conference. I actually signed up, and I think it's the first time they've had an option of literally everything being done online. So they used to have this thing, they called it the Green Pack, which was where you would get, there were certain things that would come through the post physically, but I think things like the conference agenda and the fringe stuff, that all came through email. But today I clicked the box to say that I would get everything online and by email. Well, I presume they physically send me my pass.
I was going to say, you have to have a pass, don't you?
But apart from that, in terms of all the documentation and, you know, the motions and all that gubbins, that'll all be online. And, you know, that's the way the world is moving. I know not everyone has access to this stuff, so there's always going to be this digital divide. And for them, there will always need to be some way of physically delivering things to people. You know, well, maybe eventually we'll end up where pretty much everyone has access to digital technology, but we're not there yet.
No.
But the point is that a lot of people are. I mean, I don't know what the figures are, but it's surely got to be more than 50% of the population now could conceivably get access to things like, you know, utility bills, and most of this stuff could come online. So it's dying. And I think a lot of the stuff that gets sent through the physical post now is junk mail. But of course, you've got the contradictory thing side of this, which is that companies like Amazon that have become massive, and, you know, a lot of their stuff is delivered through the Royal Mail as well. And that's probably quite profitable. So it's quite difficult to see how you could navigate a path through this in a way that is going to take into account all of the different variables and how they might pan out over the next 5, 10, 20 years. I'm not sure that any way of trying to privatise this would be able to take into account all of that stuff. And I wouldn't at all be surprised if in a few years' time we'd be looking back and thinking, you know, the government didn't get anything like as much money as they should have got for this. They sold it off massively cheap. Or it's possible that they might look back and say, well, I'm glad we got $3 billion for it, because look at the state of it.
Yeah. I mean, I suspect look at the state of it will certainly be one of the things we're saying if it goes through in the way that it's proposed to. One of the things that is quite, you know, disappointing is that mutualization hasn't been considered properly. And you know, that seems to me like the big society, the invitation to take part in the government of Britain, you know, the Lib Dems making a difference in government, new ways of thinking about things. Why aren't we looking at mutualization of the post offices?
So how would that work?
Isn't that something that we should be investigating more fully?
How do you think that would work, though?
I don't know, but it's certainly something that's been on the table and has been proposed and has just been completely shut down because the government wants to make the quick profit. So we wouldn't sell it, we'd mutualise it, literally give it to communities to run themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fundamental problem is that I remember seeing it was an article about this, it must have been about 15 years ago, actually, but it tracked a letter that was posted in the south of Cornwall and it needed to be delivered in the north of Scotland, first class. And the journalist actually followed the letter all the way through that journey. It was actually a fascinating piece because it went from the local post box, it got picked up by the postie, took it to the depot, it got sorted, it got sent to a bigger depot, then it moved on to like the airport, I think it was Bristol Airport, then it was flown up to somewhere in Scotland, and you know, and it took however long it took, but it got there, and they estimate that that costs about £8. And that this was 15 years ago when first class stamps were like, I don't know, 20p or something. Mm. So it was like it was costing 40 times as much as the face cost of a stamp. But the flip side of that is that if you post a letter in London and it needs to be delivered to somewhere else in London, it might only go through one or two sorting offices before it's delivered again. And that's much cheaper than the face cost of a postage stamp. So that universal service is profitable in some areas and not profitable in other areas. And I still think even at 60p for a first class stamp now, I still think that is subsidised. And it's still overall, when you aggregate it all up, costs more than the cost of a stamp. They always seem to have the face value of a stamp, the face cost of a stamp, below what it actually costs to run this service. And I'm sure that won't continue to happen if the...
No.
I mean, there'll probably be some rules they'll set for the first few years where it can't go up above a certain amount. But whatever rules they set, you can be sure that the private company will set them at exactly whatever they can get away with in that respect. But... yeah, I suppose it's just one of these things where you're probably never going to get a perfect solution to it. And I don't know about mutualisation, maybe. I mean, the fact that they're trying to...
Northern was consulting on a mutualisation of post offices this time last year. Where did that go?
I don't know. That's an interesting question. I'll maybe try and ask some questions about that when I next speak to senior people in the party, because, Yeah, it does seem a bit strange. The fact that they're going to give 10% of the shares to the employees, I take it that doesn't really make cut much ice with you. You don't think
No.
that's a kind of a slight form of mutualisation?
A, that's not mutualisation, that's shareholding,
Yeah.
which is a different thing. And also, 10% of shares owned by them is 90% owned by other people. That's not a mutual decision-making process.
And if it's anything like what happened with the British Telecom shares, then they won't stay in the
No, of
hands of
course they
small
won't.
shareholders for very long anyway, because they'll probably, you know, the day it's floated, they'll probably go up by 50%, and then loads of people will cash them in. So, yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, I guess maybe we'll come back to this issue in 10 years' time and we'll find out whether or not it's been a success. Okay. Well, I'll wrap up on.
I'm willing to put my money on it, not being.
Okay, well, the thing is, I would, except I'm too on the fence on this. I don't know which way it's going to go, so I wouldn't be willing to put any money on it, to be honest. Okay, I'll wrap up in a minute, but before I do, I just wanted to mention that we're going to be on holiday now for several weeks, so we're going to take a bit of a break for over the summer. However, don't fear, because we actually are in the process of recording a number of one-off specials. So I'm going to record two, in each case with a special guest invited, and Emma's going to record a couple as well. And we're going to release those over the course of the next few weeks. I don't exactly have a schedule, but the idea is certainly every week or every couple of weeks there'll be a new episode out over the summer, and then we'll both be back at the end of August, probably start of September, for normal service to be resumed. The one-offs that we're doing, we're going to try and focus a little bit more on long-term political questions and issues. So yeah, keep your eye out for those. And we've got some very interesting guests that we've invited to speak to, haven't we, Emma?
Absolutely, yes. I'm
Yeah.
looking forward to them.
So yeah, it just remains for me to thank Emma, and I hope that you have a good summer.
You too, Mark.
And also I'd like to thank Audio Boo for very kindly hosting our podcast for us on the internet. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back after the summer.